Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Jason Kelly. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Bloomberg Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
Masser is either flattered or offended by the fact that I said, I'm not sure you're really a Dave and Buster's person.
I've been checking it out. I'm good.
Okay. You're good?
Yeah, I'm
good. We don't need to go there after
and
the show.
And that means nothing.
It means nothing. It's
everybody...
just not your jam.
Yeah.
Scott DeVoe is here, Deals reporter, activist. Beat is part of his responsibility here. And the reason we have him talking about this story is KKR taking a big stake, a relatively substantial stake, a minority stake in Dave and Buster's. Disclosing that today, this is an interesting playbook here. Tell us about it, Scott.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting because they're traditionally a private equity player and you don't see them going active per se. But this is part of this trend that's starting to develop where private equity firms are becoming more like activist funds and activist funds are becoming more like private equity players.
And so tell us about this particular deal, because they're saying it's not a hostile deal. You know, that this isn't sort of a foothold to do a hostile takeover of the company. And yet, you and I were talking as we were walking out to lunch today. This is an activist play. It sort of, it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck. This is activism.
Yeah, I mean, I think you get this all the time. Nobody wants to be called an activist investor, right? But if, by my standard, if you file what's called a 13D with the SEC, you're an active investor. You might not be a traditional activist, but you are active, and that's what they've done here. So it is kind of a bit of a change for them. They said that, you know, obviously they want to talk. They've had talks with management. They want to continue having talks with management. And they have some ideas on how to improve the company's performance.
All right. So the stock is up about 12% so far today. It's a little bit off its highs. It was down about 10% last year, 19% the year before. Is this, though, Scott, more about private equity has so much money, dry powder, if you will. And so playing in the private space just doesn't cut it anymore.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And so we've started to see this. My colleague Ed Hammond broke a story earlier this week about TPG raising a new fund that they were not calling it an activist fund. But, you know, what the intent is that they're going to take minority positions in companies and try to affect change at them. So, I mean, it's an activist fund per se, but, you know, again, nobody wants to call it an activist fund.
Well, and that was what I found interesting about this disclosure by KKR, as they say, and reading from our Bloomberg coverage here, may also engage in talks with stockholders or other security holders and other relevant parties or take certain actions, including transactions and board changes. Again, that's what activists do. Why? why this company? I mean, help us understand maybe a little bit of what's going on at Dave & Buster's.
Just to be fair, though, that's pretty standard 13D language.
Sure.
So you basically have to disclose what you may or may not do. And it doesn't mean you're going to do any of this stuff. So, but in this case, and we've seen it before, they were in a company called Hanger. They disclosed 13D. In
KKR, that is.
KKR in September. And, you know, that company didn't go private. That company underwent some changes. It's up about 150% from where they were when KKR disclosed its original position. So the understanding that I have is that this is not necessarily about putting this company into play, but they do genuinely have some ideas on how they can they can improve the performance. And now Dave & Buster's has suffered a little bit. Same store sales are down. They're trying to kind of reinvent themselves a little bit, refresh their image, you know, so that they can get more people in the door. And I think, you know, private equity expertise maybe wouldn't be a bad thing.
Right.
And I do feel like the private equity guys, right, have increasingly moved into kind of the hospitality space or the restaurant space.
Sure.
So maybe, is this an add-on or tack-on to some of the other restaurant names that maybe they've invested in, and maybe they're thinking of bundling something?
I think we've definitely seen private equity go into the restaurant space. There's been a lot of companies that have gone into play, like Del Frisco's got sold, you know, Bloomin' Brands is running a process. You know, these kind of, It's an investment that's not uncommon to private equity, but I think what's important here is what they're doing is they're getting a toehold in a company that maybe potentially goes up for sale. But if they get this toehold, they already have 10%. They're going to understand the business, and that's going to give them a leg up if there is a process.
Right.
On it. And again, I'm not saying there is a process.
And it could be that they just make some changes and make some money off of the public stock. I mean, I do remember having a conversation with some very senior
KKR. Well, they've made a bunch of money today.
Right. I remember having this conversation with some very senior KKR folks, and Henry Kravis and George Roberts have been pretty public about this, that they want to be able to invest in all types of companies in all different ways, and getting past the sort of plain vanilla, as it were, LBO, the take private or the family business, just, you know, using some equity and leverage. You know, that's not the only playbook they want to have. And if they see something that's undervalued by their estimation, they want to be able to do it. All right, Scott DeVoe, thank you so much. Deals reporter, activist, expert here at Bloomberg, all over the Play story, PLAY. That's Dave & Buster's stock symbol, and KKR taking a look.
Down at the arcade, down at the arcade.
All right, so Carol Masser is either flattered or offended by the fact that I said, I'm not sure you're really a Dave & Buster's person.
I've been checking it out. I'm good.
Okay, you're good?
Yeah, I'm
You're good.
Good?
We don't need to go there after
and
the show?
And that means nothing. I'm
means
like,
nothing. It's
everybody,
just not your jam.
Yeah.
Scott DeVoe is here, deals reporter, activist. Beat is part of his responsibility here. And the reason we have him talking about this story is KKR taking a big stake, a relatively substantial stake, a minority stake in Dave & Buster's, disclosing that today. This is an interesting playbook here. Tell us about it, Scott.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting because they're traditionally a private equity player and you don't see them going active per se. But this is part of this trend that's starting to develop where private equity firms are becoming more like activist funds and activist funds are becoming more like private equity players.
And so tell us about this particular deal, because they're saying it's not a hostile deal, you know, that this isn't sort of a foothold to do a hostile takeover of the company. And yet you and I were talking as we were walking out to lunch today. This is an activist play. It sort of, it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck. This is activism.
Yeah, I mean, I think you get this all the time. Nobody wants to be called an activist investor, right? But if, by my standard, if you file what's called a 13D with the SEC, you're an active investor. You might not be a traditional activist, but you are active, and that's what they've done here. So it is kind of a bit of a change for them. They said that, you know, obviously they want to talk. They've had talks with management. They want to continue having talks with management. And they have some ideas on how to improve the company's performance.
All right. So the stock is up about 12% so far today. It's a little bit off its highs. It was down about 10% last year, 19% the year before. Is this, though, Scott, more about private equity has so much money, dry powder, if you will. And so playing in the private space just doesn't cut it anymore.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And so we've started to see this. We, you know, my colleague Ed Hammond broke a story earlier this week about TPG raising a new fund that they were not calling it an activist fund. But, you know, what the intent is that they're going to take minority positions in companies and try to affect change at them. So, I mean, it's an activist fund per se, but, you know, again, nobody wants to call it an activist fund.
Well, and that was what I found interesting about this disclosure by KKR, as they say, and reading from our Bloomberg coverage here, may also engage in talks with stockholders or other security holders in other relevant parties or take certain actions, including transactions and board changes. Again, that's what activists do. Why this company? I mean, help us understand maybe a little bit of what's going on at Dave & Buster's.
Just to be fair, though, that's pretty standard 13D language.
Sure.
So you basically have to disclose what you may or may not do. And it doesn't mean you're going to do any of this stuff. So, but in this case, and we've seen it before, they were in a company called Hanger. They disclosed 13D.
KKR,
in September. And, you know, that company didn't go private. That company underwent some changes. It's up about 150% from where they were when KKR disclosed its original position. So the understanding that I have is that this is not necessarily about putting this company into play, but they do genuinely have some ideas on how they can they can improve the performance. And now Dave & Buster's has suffered a little bit. Same store sales are down. They're trying to kind of reinvent themselves a little bit, refresh their image, you know, so that they can get more people in the door. And I think, you know, private equity expertise maybe wouldn't be a bad thing.
Right.
And I do feel like the private equity guys, right, have increasingly moved into kind of the hospitality space or the restaurant space.
Sure.
So maybe, is this an add-on or tack-on to some of the other restaurant names that maybe they've invested in, and maybe they're thinking of bundling something?
I think we've definitely seen private equity go into the restaurant space. There's been a lot of companies that have gone into play, like Del Frisco's got sold, you know, Bloomin' Brands is running a process. You know, these kind of, It's an investment that's not uncommon to private equity, but I think what's important here is what they're doing is they're getting a toehold in a company that maybe potentially goes up for sale. But if they get this toehold, they already have 10%. They're going to understand the business, and that's going to give them a leg up if there is a process on
right.
it. And again, I'm not saying there is a process.
And it could be that they just make some changes and make some money off of the public stock. I mean,
exactly.
I do remember having a conversation with some very senior
KKR. Well, they made
KKR,
a bunch of money today.
Right. I remember having this conversation with some very senior KKR folks, and Henry Kravis and George Roberts have been pretty public about this, that they want to be able to invest in all types of companies in all different ways, and getting past the sort of plain vanilla, as it were, LBO, the take private or the family business, just, you know, using some equity and leverage. You know, that's not the only playbook they want to have. And if they see something that's undervalued by their estimation, they want to be able to do it. All right, Scott DeVoe, thank you so much. Deals reporter, activist expert here at Bloomberg, all over the Play story, PLAY. That's Dave & Buster's stock symbol, and KKR taking a look. All right, so a couple stories that caught our attention in the magazine this week. One is going forward, what happens to those companies that Carlos Ghosn left behind? We loved hearing about, I mean, the unbelievable reporting by Matt Campbell and team about the escape of Carlos Ghosn, his arrival in Lebanon, what happens next for him legally. But there is this whole matter of these two companies that he was running, Renault and Nissan, we're talking about. Joel Weber, the editor of the magazine, is here with us in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. You've really done a nice job telling the story very holistically. Tell us about the strategy that's going on at these two car companies.
Well, so this is like the chaos that Ghosn kind of wrought, right? Like, everyone's been captivated by that, like you said. We've had some amazing reporting by Matt Campbell and team about sort of how that went down. What's been really interesting, though, is the other side of the story of, like, what happens to this alliance that, you know, so Ghosn basically architected it, largest auto alliance in the world. And ever since he's not been on the picture, it's all sort of fallen apart. What was interesting was that it kind of came to a moment at the end of 2019 where there was sort of a little bit of a truce, it felt like. Things were sort of starting to get stable. But then once he's free, it's now again sort of in free fall.
Yeah, well, exactly. And holding that press conference, right, and pointing the finger and naming names in terms of our individuals that he faults for, like, the problems, kind of re-upped all of the, I feel like, antagonism between the two sides.
And that's right. And, you know, I think the biggest thing to keep in mind here is sort of the existential moment for the auto industry as a whole. And Ghosn was aware of that, right? And he was actually, you know, in conversations, according to him, with Fiat among others, to try the Fiat Chrysler conversation, to see if it could even go one level bigger than that. And so he throws shade at you know, his former colleagues for basically throwing him under the bus here, because he had seen what was coming and was, you know, strategically able to be the one that could kind of pull this kind of deal off. But, you know, thinking about this alliance now, it is really tenuous because they no longer have that ability to do that merger. Mm-hmm. And yet the complications of the auto industry, as the Nissan story really showed, like, Nissan looks terrible right now.
Right.
So in theory, and we say this in the story, the need for the alliance is more important than ever, because the industry is really pivoting towards that electrical self-driving moment, and none of these automakers are ready for that.
But what's also interesting is Renault needs Nissan too. It's its biggest asset, so it gets a ton of money in terms of dividends from the company. So they are so, I love how this story talks about that these two companies are so intertwined in terms of factories and production and crisscrossing. Like, you don't,
well, not even that, but like even just the political side of it. Correct. And how complicated that is. So you've got all these pieces that you can't quite separate, and that's why it's such a messy thing. And we're not totally clear how it even resolves from here, but they came together because they were stronger together than they were apart. It seems like that logic remains true still, but everyone involved in it seems to sort of hate each other at the moment.
Right.
So,
all right. Yeah. So, speaking of strategy stories elsewhere in the magazine, this was a feature that I know we loved reading about as well. Forever 21, I mean, familiar, I think, to a number of shoppers, especially, I believe they had a big location down in Lower Manhattan.
Kiddo. So the story of Forever 21 is a fascinating one. And this is a company that boomed over the last decade. And it turns out, though, that maybe they weren't quite ready for that boom. And they went bankrupt in the fall. What's been kind of fascinating, and the story really dives into this, is like, who owns it? And
right.
It's this Korean couple owned still, I think, 99% of it. And yet they don't really talk to each other. They have handlers who own, you know, another couple that only the woman deals with the woman, and the man deals with the man. And they have houses that are often near each other. What's really important about Forever 21, though, is this is a global company, sprawling empire. And you know who loves them? Malls.
Yeah.
Malls are the people that love Forever 21, because Forever 21 means you have young foot traffic.
Yep.
And you have gigantic footprints, and if you're filling malls right now, you need both of those things. You need people paying rent, and you need foot traffic. And the promise of Forever 21 was that they were supposed to deliver on that.
As the mom of a teenage girl, I mean, there is a point, I think, in almost every young girl's life that they at some point are shopping there, and they may not do it for a long time.
This is why I was looking at you, and then looked at me like I was insane.
Well, I said to you when she was younger, but like,
I was remembering.
But they're kind of in and out with it, but it's not expensive, and so it's easy. Like, you know what I mean? It's manageable.
Well, it was a fast fashion brand, right?
Totally.
That was
like
exactly what this thing did well,
really,
and
fast.
It went global with it. But what was really interesting when we dug into the reporting, and the team did an amazing job on this, was sort of the lack of market research that the company seemed willing or able to do. So they were oftentimes shipping furs to countries where furs were like not even in season, right?
Wow.
Like, so winter apparel in South America when it's not even that season for winter jackets, and boxes of inventory just filling up. So even fast fashion sort of has its downfalls. I mean, the whole point of the idea,
like, know your market,
is to know your market and be able to respond to it.
All right. So, minute left, Joel Weber. What's the thread through this week's issue?
Bankruptcy, interestingly enough. Yeah. Like, I mean, we've had this Forever 21 story in this mix. We felt like, especially the moment that it really matters now is here at the end of January. We've gone through the holiday season. It's a reckoning as they deal with their creditors of like, what does this company look like going forward? And then, you know, on
the cover story.
And back to the cover story, Leon Black, not affiliated with Forever 21 at all. But a person who has really thrived on companies at moments of weakness, and he's made himself and investors very wealthy by navigating the shoals.
Yeah, no, it's a great issue. We really enjoyed reading it. You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week right here on Bloomberg Radio. I loved this story.
I loved it too, because it was another deep dive in the magazine by a great reporter, Business Week writer Claire Suddeth. It's about the second most popular dating app in the U.S. It's supposed to offer women a better option, but she really goes in search of trying to find an answer for the question, does it? So this story online at Bloomberg.com and also coming up in the magazine as well. She's in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. We're talking about Bumble.
Yes, we are.
So tell us, for those, I have to be quite honest with you. I know there was a Sharon Stone story about Bumble, and I feel like it got a lot of attention. I didn't know a whole heck of a lot about it.
Yeah, so unless you're a millennial
who online dates. Okay.
You may not be too familiar with Bumble, but if you do online date, you will have definitely heard of it, because it is the second largest dating app in the U.S. outside of Tinder, obviously. It has millions and millions of people. It's been around for about 5 years, and it's sort of defining characteristic. It was founded by this woman named Whitney Wolf-Heard.
Who co-founded Tinder too, right?
Yeah, she was one of the co-founders of Tinder. Okay. She had this like very public sexual harassment lawsuit in 2014. That same year, she started Bumble, and its defining characteristic is that once you swipe right on each other, a man and a woman, only the woman can message the man first. The man cannot talk to the woman first. She has said for years that this reduces harassment. They've instituted all these other safety features, and they often publicly will talk about, you know, because of this, they're empowering women. They have lower harassment and abuse rates than, you know, all their competitors, other dating apps. And it sounds great. Mm-hmm. You know, it does prevent men from sending you a nasty first message, but it doesn't necessarily prevent the other harassment later down the line or change anything really about relationships. So I started looking into, well, so what are they actually doing? What do they know? And then I talked to all these employees and former employees who worked there, who said, actually, Bumble doesn't really do any testing whatsoever on whether or not its claims are true.
Which is kind of like, I think about it from a reporter's perspective, and you're a great reporter, and like that would be one of the things you said. Okay, so what are the metrics that you find that, you know, you've got this big mission? How you doing?
Yeah, it's kind of a natural follow-up question, right?
Yeah, I mean, so that, you know, the way that this sort of came about is I thought they were doing really good stuff. And so I was like, this is exciting. Tell me about your company. And they said, well, we have the lowest abuse rates of any platform. And I said, what are those? And they said, oh, we don't actually know them. And it went from there. You know, they have this, they also have a platonic version of the app for people looking to find friends. And then they have this sort of business networking version.
Right.
Supposedly that empowers women as well. But it, your profile looks like a dating profile. So right. I found that I just got a lot of weird messages from men wanting to offer me like free Pilates classes. That does not help my career whatsoever.
Yeah.
I don't really understand how that is empowering at all.
And tell us about Whitney Wolf-Heard, because, you know, this is a company, it feels like, that for better or worse, sort of embodies her personality in many ways. I mean, the tone is very much set by her. You spent a fair amount of time with her.
Yeah, Whitney is, I think, a very forward-thinking and, you know,
and seemingly well-meaning.
Well-meaning, like, individual, very smart. You know, she went to Southern Methodist University, and she talks a lot about how she felt like there was this old-fashioned way of dating where women had to wait for men to ask them out, and women couldn't do certain things waiting for men to sort of court them, and she wanted to flip that around. But when I talk to people who actually used Bumble, on the one hand, women generally still didn't do that asking out. They had to send the first message, but they still waited mostly for men to ask them out. And then also some men that I talked to said, I don't know, women ask men out, and it doesn't really matter whether it was on Bumble or Tinder or anything right. like that. So,
and yeah. How much of the Tinder experience do you think informed, again, for better and worse, what Bumble has become?
I think it actually, you have to have Tinder before you can have Bumble.
Right.
Not just because Whitney had to found Tinder before she founded Bumble. But, you know, Tinder was the first real successful dating app that made it easy to find people on your phone. Everything else before then was basically a website.
Right.
And, you know, it sort of led to this hookup culture. There are all these, like, memes, bad Tinder dates, you know, a lot of harassment, people sending terrible messages to each other. And so Bumble comes out and says, hey, we're basically the same thing, although they are in a lawsuit with Match Group over their intellectual property, over swiping left and right. But, you know, hey, we're basically also a dating app, but we've fixed the harassment problem.
I have to just say, there are so many things that jump out for me, but you cited some research from, or data from Pew Research Center. More than 40% of people in the U.S. have been harassed or threatened online. 40%. Women, especially those under 30, are more than twice as likely to receive some kind of sexually violent threats that they find very upsetting. And what was interesting about this, that they were on a mission to improve this, and if they could figure it out, think about what they could do from all of social media, but they're not there, just quickly, right?
Yeah, and it's a very difficult problem to tackle. You know, Facebook, Twitter, they're all trying to do it. And the problem is that you can't just ban certain words and be done with it, which is basically what Bumble is doing.
All right. It's a great story. Definitely check it out online and on the Bloomberg terminal. Claire Sutter, writer for Bloomberg Businessweek. Terrific piece.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
That's a good song for this.
Yeah, we're talking BlackRock. We've been following this story all along, and it's really kind of found its way into a couple different conversations on the company itself and more broadly. We're talking about BlackRock putting climate change at the center of its $7 trillion strategy. That is perspective, Jason, because it just reminds you how much money that they are involved in on a regular basis. And because of that, they can certainly bring about change.
Right. And there are direct impacts to this. There are indirect impacts.
Yes.
Let's get into it with Shaheen Contractor, ESG Associate Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. She's here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. Nice to have you back.
Thank you.
All right. So this is a really smart piece of analysis because I feel like what we're trying to do constantly with ESG is really look at where the rubber meets the road. BlackRock has been saying a lot of things of late. Tell us what they've been saying and what it means, especially as it relates to coal.
Sure. So in a letter to shareholders, BlackRock CEO Larry Fink committed to a number of things. So most notably is this move to reduce coal exposure by divesting companies from its active portfolio. Now, this is a strong signal to companies. However, we don't think it could have much of an impact because at the end of the day, BlackRock is a large passive holder, and this policy is specifically for its active funds.
So the key word he used was active.
Active.
Right?
Pretty much.
We know, as you just pointed out, that, and this was pointed out really magnificently in the magazine and the cover story 2 weeks ago, that the passive holdings that BlackRock and the other of the big three have are huge. Tell us about the scope here.
Of course. So we actually did this analysis, and we see that of BlackRock's investments in coal companies, 90% are passive investments. So these won't be touched. Just a note, this is only looking at Bloomberg's ETF and mutual fund data. So it could change if you look at BlackRock's institutional investments. But still,
so
largely
wah,
passive
wah, wah. This means it's not got as much bang as we thought?
It sends a strong signal, and divestments as a whole will continue to increase. So as a message, it's right, but as an impact, not so much.
Yeah, it's like kind of a, hey.
Yeah, it's like, hey guys, maybe. Like, maybe you should think about not doing this exactly that way. And yet, it does feel like, and I'd be fascinated by your perspective on this, Shaheen, that we are at a moment where, A, this is being talked about a lot more.
100%.
And there is a sense that as BlackRock goes, so go other investors.
Yes.
It's hard to quantify, but help us understand maybe the mood shift out there.
Of course. So divestment as a whole has continued to increase. A number of insurers, banks, and now even diversified miners are starting to divest their coal assets.
Mm.
So one interesting comparison is Norway's sovereign wealth fund, their policy they put last year.
Right.
So another point about BlackRock is it has a revenue threshold limit of 25%. So this excludes large diversified miners like Glencore or BHP that produce large quantities of coal. But Norway's sovereign wealth fund put a quantity limit. So anything above 20 million tons, they excluded.
Interesting.
So these miners would get excluded from Norway's policy, but still included under BlackRock. So very different policies, but definitely a divestment movement that's taking place.
I have to say, it's still, I think, good to see this in the conversation, right? Folks are thinking about, you know, what ESG means more broadly and starting to put parameters in terms of investments and thinking about things like climate change.
Definitely.
I mean, as you say, even baby steps, that's how you learn, right?
Well, and it also...
That's how you start.
Right, exactly.
And it also does feel like that even outside of ESG funds, and we've seen some of those, you know, impact type funds at the KKRs and the TPGs of the world. When investors are going before a pension board, or as you point out rightly, Shaheen, a sovereign wealth fund, an endowment, they're asking those questions, right? They're asking, what are you holding? How much
Correct.
Is it? And I want to get a little bit more under the covers.
It's very it's very driven by your clientele,
right?
Especially institutional investors, if that's what it is.
Right. All right. Very, very smart
Great.
Analysis. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank
Shaheen
you.
Contractor, ESG Associate Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. Her piece of an analysis is all about BlackRock and essentially pointing out that the carbon exposure that they're trying to cut, well, it's sort of limited when you get into the fine print. That
the
it's
devil
only
is
going,
in the details,
the devil
isn't it?
Continues to be in the details. Funny how that happens, especially on Wall Street.
Exactly, exactly.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no, 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 no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
It is time for the Drive to the Close, wrapping up this week of trading. It is Friday. Let's bring in Ryan Dietrich. He's Senior Market Strategist at LPL Financial, roughly $706 billion in assets under management. He's joining us on the phone from Charlotte, North Carolina. Ryan, I always think about a week like this, where despite some of the big news stories out of Washington and getting through bank earnings and all that good stuff, you know, what are the technicals telling us potentially about this continual drive by investors to take on risk?
Yeah, hey, Carol, thanks for having me back. And did I hear you guys are going to have snow this weekend?
They say.
True fact.
Oh, boy.
True fact.
Well, down here in Charlotte, we don't have that problem.
Ryan.
Yeah, good luck, guys. I'm in New York in 2 weeks, so keep the snow away in 2 weeks. Nonetheless, you know, when you look at technicals, we clearly have had a great run. We know that S&P is looking at maybe being up 5 straight months if we can close higher in January. So when we look at the world here, near term, extremely stretched. You know, I like to look at, you know, market technicals and look at market sentiment too. I think they are kind of connected. Various put-to-call ratios, people excited. Look at ETF flows, a lot of money coming in. I mean, hey, things are great, right? 12 months ago, they weren't like that. So we're a little more cautious here just because some of the optimism that's coming in. I mean, I've been bullish to you guys for a while, coming on saying, hey, we're going higher. But right now, we are getting a little more cautious because everyone else is so excited.
All right. So one of the charts that you shared with us I find so fascinating, and it's all under the auspices of geopolitical market shock events. And man, I got to tell you, I look back at this and you go all the way back to Pearl Harbor. Put this recent volatility, this geopolitical volatility, in context for us.
Well, Jason, that's right. You know, we went back to Pearl Harbor back in 1941. There were 20 geopolitical events. What we found, the S&P falls about 5% on average after these big events for about 3 weeks. Good news, within 2.5 months, the S&P makes up those gains. So you tend to have pullbacks, but then things kind of keep going higher. And you put it in perspective now, guys, we've gone over 3 months without a 1% move up or down on the S&P 500, okay? I mean, we've really not had much volatility at all on this recent, you know, with the Iran issues that we've just had. So it's really unique. I mean, yes, we've had futures down, you know, a couple Tuesdays ago when the strikes happened, we were concerned. But, boy, the market just takes it in stride. And the one thing we found, we looked at those 20 times, some of the worst returns took place when? During recessions. You had the geopolitical concern, but you had a recession. And I'll tell you, look at the recent data we're seeing. We just don't see a recession happening in 2020, and that's kind of where we found it. So it's almost like, you know, use it as opportunity if the economy's strong is something that still makes sense to us.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think our Dave Wilson has looked at things like this, that when you've got a big up year, what happens the following year? You guys have done the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, Dave might have quoted me, actually, I think, on that one. And
I believe
right.
I believe he did cite you.
Thank you, Dave. That's always nice when he does that. But, yeah, I mean, we took a look when the S&P's up 30%, because that's the big thing we're getting from our advisors and their clients. Oh, my goodness, the stock market's up so much, we have to pull back. And there's some truth to that. But what we found, when you're up 30%, the next year was actually higher 10 out of 12 times, 15% on average for the S&P. Now, we're not really expecting a 15% rally, but what we think it helps reinforce is the fact that you absolutely can have continued gains after big rallies. And that's just kind of what history tells us. History is a guide. You know, we don't follow it blindly, but let's not ignore it either.
And so I guess from a historical perspective, or maybe from a current perspective, you know, you think about a week like this. I mean, we were marveling at this at the top of the show and really throughout the week, that the sort of political volatility we saw this week, the optics of, you know, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court being sworn in for an impeachment trial, only the third time this has happened in the history of America, and we are in record territory again. I have to wonder, I mean, I know that the this time it's different argument is always so dangerous, Ryan, but do you look at that at a week like this and marvel a little?
Well, you have to a little bit, right? I mean, but don't forget, in 1998, when President Clinton was impeached, the S&P was up 40% 6 months later. So we're not saying that's going to happen, but that's how to look at it. But what's going on right now is the whole global picture. I mean, Europe's gone nowhere for 21 years. Europe, the Euro Stock 600, is breaking out to all-time highs. Of course, we're all-time highs here, 52-week highs across the board in Europe. And we're really encouraged by what's happening with emerging markets. Emerging markets the last 3 months, I think quietly, are all of a sudden starting to lead, take that baton. That's kind of our opinion that there's not a global recession happening. And if there's not a global recession, EM, which is a place that might see 14% earnings growth this year, almost double probably what we're going to have in the U.S., emerging markets, maybe it's finally their time to take that baton. And that's a place that we're investing for our LPL advisors, actually. We like emerging markets in 2020.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was just looking at the chart, right? We have seen a pretty decent uptick going back to the low back in August. When you think about emerging markets, Ryan, how do you play it?
Yeah, I mean, we just like some of the big ETFs.
Okay.
Like, you know, that's kind of the way we look at it. But what we like about it is just the fact that trade all of a sudden is finally starting to calm down. The U.S. dollar, we think, is looking toppy. That's historically a tailwind. And then those earnings and valuations, EM's the cheapest thing out there. So we still like it from that point of view as well.
All right, so how are you feeling about your Panthers down there? Pretty good?
Oh, wow, new coach?
Well, now, actually, I'm from Cincinnati, okay?
Oh,
so I'm
boy.
A Bengals fan. So we were terrible, but you know what? Welcome back to Ohio, Joe Burrow. We will take him.
Hey.
And open arms. We're ready to move off Mandy Dalton, so
all
give
right.
Joe Burrow.
All right, yeah, that does feel pretty good. Ohio boy made good, you know, couldn't click there at Ohio State, but man, he really proved him wrong down in the bayou, that's for sure. Yeah, that's exciting. We had another guest in here yesterday who's a Kansas City guy, also is a Cincinnati Bengals fan. And, man, you guys have had a tough go of it. But you're right. Maybe Joe Burrow will turn it all around. Ryan Dietrich, great to catch up with you, senior market strategist for LPL Financial, looking after about $706 billion that firm is. He joined us on the phone from Charlotte, North Carolina. Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show every weekday at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.